This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
You know, I think that storytelling element is really important. I'll sit there and I'll send out 50 one-to-one emails if I need to. And I think, you know, we need to be able to do these basic things to be efficient in what we're doing. I mean, hey, everyone needs a failed startup, so that's how I look at it these days. I can't give away all my secrets.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, number episode 35, and it has been a while. Sadly, life kind of got a little bit on top of me. Lots of stuff happening in our consulting business, simondell.com, and lots of new clients and all those kind of things. And I just haven't got round to managing to do a podcast lately. But we're back, and we're back with a new producer, Hannah. Hannah at simondell.com. If you want to be on the show or you think you've got an interesting story, all those kind of bits and pieces, then please email her. She would love to hear from you, and we will try and see if we can book you in. But we are back. We do have lots of new people lined up to go on the podcast. And this week we are starting with a lady called Louisa Dahl, who runs an event company called Interactive Minds. So interactiveminds.com.au. Please go and check that out. It is a event for marketers focusing on digital marketing. So very much in the space that that I'm in. And it's been going for 10 years and it runs across Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne and Newcastle. So by no small feat that Louisa has grown this business to a massive, well-recognized brand. And she's going to talk about her history building that business, some of the other jobs that she's done in the past. And she's also going to talk a lot about digital marketing and some of the things that she does in her business and some of the things that she recommends other people do. If you would like to find out a little bit more about our business and myself and my business partner, Matt, come to simondell.com. Our Instagram, which is now simondell.com. It was something else, but it's now simondell.com, dot spelt D-O-T, not a little black dot. Come and follow us on Instagram. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. Please rate and review this show. We moved from SoundCloud to Audio Boom about 8 weeks ago, which is quite coincides with me getting stroppy and not doing a couple of podcasts for a few weeks. And we managed to lose all of our ratings and reviews on iTunes. So clever Simon. Yeah, it's all Simon's fault. Oh dear, never mind. So please don't. If you ever want to migrate a podcast, for God's sake, don't come and ask me to do it because I will screw it up. But anyway, so if you can go and rate and review us, that would be fantastic. Otherwise, sit tight and listen into the fantastic interview with Louisa Dahl from Interactive Minds. I am lucky enough this week to be joined by Louisa Dahl, who is the founder and CEO of an event organization called Interactive Minds. And I shall read the blurb off LinkedIn just to save me some time. And it says, Interactive Minds runs regular events and programs to keep digital marketers informed of the latest industry trends, change and opportunities. And that sentence doesn't really give it half the justice that it deserves. But welcome to the show, Louisa. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you for having me. And I'm glad I updated that blurb sometime in the last few years.
Do you want to give us a bit, kind of give us that kind of 2 minute elevator pitch of what Interactive Minds does? Because I think for everybody out there, it has been running for over 10 years now. So it's not like something you dreamed up last week. It's quite a significant organization now.
That's right. Yeah. So Interactive Minds, I guess the bread and butter of what we do is we run events and programs for marketers to help them to stay up to date in the fast moving world of digital. So we started off 10 years ago, as you said, and nowadays we run about 25 events a year across Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne and Newcastle. And we're also adding to, I suppose, our suite and our offering doing mastermind programs and the like for members as well. So expanding beyond the events these days.
Cool. I guess my first question with all of this is what on earth brought you to do events? Because everybody I know that runs events kind of, you know, spends most of their time pulling their hair out or wanting to stab themselves. So what brought you into that world?
happenstance, I would say. It wasn't really the plan, although I have to admit that way back when I was at uni, I came up with the idea of running a party management business, which never really got off the ground. But sometimes I wonder if there was something in that way back then.
Hold on. We're going to have to talk about that. Talk to me, party management. What sort of parties are we talking about here? Was it an excuse for you to try and get lots of people drunk? Was that where that was going?
Maybe that was it. I was a uni student studying marketing and business, and you know, these were early days of the internet back then. It wasn't super easy to find venues or get information from providers about things. And I guess I saw the frustration in that and thought that perhaps I could compile some stuff and shortcut it. So as I said, it never really got off the ground, but it was an idea that I think I went far enough to register a business name.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That was about it.
How things could have changed drastically
had
that been a success.
That's right. Yes. But as life happens, you know, a decade later, I came back to events. So there you go.
Right. So what was your, I ask everyone this, what was your first job? What was the first time that you did something and actually got paid for it all those years ago?
Well, the first job I'm probably willing to admit to, I think, would be my first proper job when I was 14. I started working at Franklin's, if you remember that.
No, what was checkout tick. Franklin's? Right.
Franklin's, okay. No Frills. It was a supermarket.
Right. Okay.
It was a little bit short-lived, that one, and I ended up moving on to Coles, where I worked for most of my uni career, but Franklin's got me the very first time.
Whilst you're on Coles there, I'm going to ask you this because we had a bit of an argument about this a couple of weeks ago on one of the other shows. What do you think about the whole little mini brand things? What's your take on all that?
Oh, look, I personally have been trying to avoid them. I have three children and I thought I can get out of this one. So I have mostly got out of it, which I've been pretty happy about. I think their timing of that campaign was obviously pretty rough.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, I think there's always improvements to be made on that type of thing. I'm not a big fan of all the supermarket campaigns that are run these days. I think they're a little bit unnecessary and put a little bit of pressure on parents, really.
Yeah.
So, avoid was my tactic for that one.
Smart move. I normally sort of go through the sort of timeline of people's careers and things, but if anybody looks on Louise's LinkedIn later on, there's quite a few jobs in there, and that's not to suggest you're old in any way, because I don't you know, obviously we don't want to talk about people's ages and things like that, but you have done one or two things in your past.
Yes.
the early years of digital marketing in agencies, and you've done it in government and things like that. How did you get into that?
Well, as I said, I did marketing at university, and in my last term, I decided to go and get a job. So, you know, back then I looked it up in the paper and I cut it out. I actually still have that job listing somewhere. And I got a job at an internet company, being a marketing assistant. So that was really my first forte into, you know, practicing as a marketer. And the fact that I ended up in an internet startup was fortuitous, because that's a bit of a passion of mine as well. So I started off doing a whole range of, you know, very early day digital marketing. And I'm talking about, you know, search engine submissions and news groups and building websites with, you know, basic content on them to promote products, basically. And in fact, worked on a very early day, you know, what you might call now a social media website, which is no longer around. But,
what was that one?
It was called rememory.com. And it was a place for people to go and share their memories.
Right. Okay.
This is back in 99. So well before, you know, social media became a thing, and it was an uphill struggle. It was very difficult.
Right in the middle of that .com boom. Really,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yes. Right before the crash.
Yes. So how did you find it? Not so much how did you find it, but when you look back on it now and you think about the difference in the way that digital is now, is there anything that's still, and I've asked this of a couple of people before, but is there anything still that you think is valuable for people to do that perhaps people were doing back then?
I think the techniques have changed quite a lot, but yet some of the basic concepts are still the same. I mean, I still say that about my degree, really, you know, the marketing principles that you learn, and even customer service that I learned when I was at Coles. I don't want to undervalue that. That was an amazing contribution to my career. Albeit it was just a part-time uni job.
Yeah.
But I think those things still very much hold true. And I really value the very hands-on experience and the way I started my career that way. And being able to, you know, hands-on do all the tactics and do all the news group posts. And I don't know if anyone's done news groups before, but that was, you know, very tedious, long work to post things on news groups and hope that someone saw it.
So,
I mean, you know, definitely that stuff's not around anymore, but there's still a lot of, you know, trial and error. There's still a lot of different things to consider. So whilst a lot's changed, sometimes, you know, some of it hasn't as well.
Have you always sort of been entrepreneurial? Do you consider yourself that?
Yes. Yes, these days I do. I guess it wasn't something that I ever really thought about. Oh, having said that, I just told you I started a business while I was at uni. So maybe I guess being exposed to the startup as well early on when I was working there definitely gave me some insights. Yeah. And I think fueled that passion of mine. And over my time, I have created kind of three businesses that actually traded. I think three, maybe four. So, yeah, I've definitely, you know, dabbled in a few different things over the years.
I guess back in those days, when you were looking at starting a party business at university, it wasn't so much that kind of startup, starting a business wasn't as fashionable and trendy as it is today, really, was it?
No way. Exactly. There was a lot less support. In fact, I don't think there was really any community around startups or entrepreneurs back then. That's definitely a much more recent thing. I think, you know, even in the last, or even 5 years ago, I don't think it was as big and as supportive as it is now by any means.
Do you think that's, I'm going to go off on a bit of a tangent here, but do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? And I suspect you're going to say a good thing, but my question around that is, do you think the whole startup ecosystem now sort of delivers a level of, what's the best phrase here, false hope in terms of, you know, in terms of someone with an idea?
Yeah, look, I would definitely agree with that. I think there's a lot of support out there, but that it can be mistaken for thinking that it's easy and that it's going to be an easy ride. And I don't think anyone, myself included, can ever anticipate what's involved in starting a business and running it. It's always a lot harder than what you expect. And, you know, as we know, it takes a lot more time and a lot more money. I think people think that you have an idea and that's enough. Yeah. And I've spoken to many, many people who have ideas and I just can't see how that's going to work. And, you know, I'm definitely no expert in picking winners necessarily, but at the same time, you know, I think you need something unique and you need, you know, a way to bring it to life that makes sense. And I don't think a lot of startups have necessarily got far enough to, you know, make that value there.
It's funny. I see exactly the same thing, but I also see two other things, which is people that have been running a particular startup for a long time or have been involved in startups for a long time and just seem to have gotten nowhere. You know, like the revenue's not there, the value proposition isn't there, but somehow they're still chugging along and you just kind of wonder, you know, when are they going to realise that they're either not cut out for it, it's not the right idea. So I kind of see a lot of that, but I also see a lot of big businesses where I see CEOs and managers and everything that have been in business for 10, 20 years. And I go, I can't believe this is still running. Mm. You know, it's for various different reasons. So I guess it kind of, you know, across the spectrum from, you know, big businesses down to startups, that some people you look at and just go, how the hell is this business still going?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'm the first to admit that it's no easy ride. I mean, I'm 10 years into Interactive Minds and I would say that, you know, I'm probably more passionate than ever about what's ahead right now. Yeah. But I've definitely had stages throughout where I go, why am I doing this? This is just ridiculous.
And
particularly, you know, we'll probably talk about this, but Interactive Minds very much started as a side project for me. And turning that into a full-time job is actually a really tough thing as well. So, yeah, there's a lot involved in that. And I think, you know, I'm still only so early in the journey.
We'll come back to the early days of Interactive Minds a bit later. I want to touch base on one of the other things in your career was Skimp.
Yes.
Can you explain? Because I read that and went, oh, actually, that doesn't sound like a particularly bad idea. So explain to me what Skimp was, because this was back in 2009, was it? Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So I came up with this bright idea of a startup. I already had Interactive Minds at that point, but I thought I needed something else.
Of course.
And came up with this idea of Skimp because I think at the time I was building a house around then, and I was buying white goods and furniture, and I felt very frustrated that the price on the product in store could always be negotiated and you never really knew if you were getting a good deal or not.
Yeah.
And then I heard of organizations like Union Shopper. I don't even know if they're still around, actually. I assume they are. But Union Shopper was available to people in unions, like teachers and police officers and things like
that. Yep.
And they basically provided a service where you could tell them what product you wanted, and they went and negotiated for you and got access to commercial rates on those products.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, imagine if I could do that, but put it online and open it to everyone. So that you effectively get some kind of benefit through bulk flow, not of an individual product, but by getting, you know, a good sized community together. And then use the commercial divisions to actually provide us with that direct pricing. So that was the concept there. I had arrangements with a lot of commercial divisions of companies like JB Hi-Fi and RT Edwards and a bunch of others. And I had a website built that enabled people to come on and tell me the product they wanted. And then we would source the best product from, the best price for that product from multiple suppliers and go back to them. So that was the concept there. On the client side, to get the customers, I partnered with organizations like National Seniors and membership groups to try and get the bulk that we needed, and ran that business for about 2 years, which was a very hard
What took you
song.
Out of that?
Changes to the industry primarily. And also we were limited by technology. I mean, whilst that sounds really easy, what the process I just described, there was a piece where it had to go offline. We weren't plugged into all the suppliers' databases.
Right,
so this wasn't
a
real-time price that we could get. It meant that we could get a price within 24 hours, but it was, you know, there was still a bit of manual in there, at least, you know, some from the supplier's side of things. And yeah, it was tough. We wanted to go to that next stage, but we also didn't necessarily have the volume to warrant it, to warrant the further development. And then the industry really had a lot of trauma going through it, I would say. Several retailers went out of business in 2012, and a few of them then came back to me and said, oh, we can't do what we've been doing anymore.
Right.
So we either need to do it a different way and make you a supplier, or, you know, effectively a retailer, which I didn't want to be. I had to make the tough decision then to, you know, either keep going or not. And
how
as
did
it was
you,
self-funded all the way along.
At what point did you go, that's it. I don't want to do this. Was there kind of like one single moment, light bulb moment that you just went?
I think there was a week. There was a week where I lost two providers that I had currently, you know, been using. And a third one that I was talking to went out of business, and I just went, like, I think that was Wow Sight and Sound went out of business or something like that.
Yeah, it would have done me.
And I'd been negotiating with them at the time, and I just went, oh, this is crazy. I'm just, you know, beating my head against a wall. Not to mention at that point I had a one-year-old and a three-year-old. I kind of just went, what am I doing this for? This is crazy.
That's tough. That's really tough, I guess. And what did you put? Like almost 3 years into it there, didn't you?
Yeah, nearly 3 years. Yeah. So it was everyone needs a failed startup. So that's how I look at it these days.
I was going to say, what's the one big lesson out of that that you look back on and go, and that you're thankful for learning out of that?
Oh, look, that's a good question, actually. I think just the process as a whole. I mean, I actually built that business pretty much by myself.
Right.
So I was doing supplier side, I was doing marketing, I was briefing website dev in, I was, you know, managing glitches in the systems and any little manual bits in there. I did have one person helping me part-time, but, you know, I think I tried to do that off the smell of an oily rag, which is a bit of a lesson. And yeah, just probably taking on too much at the end of the day, and that some things can't necessarily be an easy fix either. You know, I think we still have the same problem in that particular industry. But, you know, things are changing. Appliances Online is around, and I think they've made a big dent in the industry as well.
Yeah. And Kogan and people like that.
Yeah, exactly. There's just definitely new ways to go about it now too.
And now Amazon, of course, as well.
That's right.
You eventually start their reach into the Australian market in that space. But
yeah.
I mean, exactly. I think everybody, Everybody, I think you're absolutely right. Everybody needs a failed startup in their life. it's better to at least get to the end, you know, get to the end on your deathbed and sit there and go, well, at least I had a go, as opposed to sitting there, you know, regretting all those things.
And do you know, when I actually did decide to close it down, and I did it, you know, it took about 3 days, I think, for me making the decision to actually having it down. The relief was huge.
Yeah,
like it had been a big stress. So yeah, that I think, you know, that enabled me to move forward with other parts of my life, and no regrets.
Okay. Good. What's been the secret of your success of Interactive Minds? Because I mean, I've been to a few events pretty earlier in the day, in its life cycle. And as I said earlier on, there's a lot of people that try and do events. There's a lot of people that try and do business events and networking events and educational things. And generally, most of them fail, or certainly never get to the point where they're running across four or five different cities and with 25 events throughout the year. What's been the secret for that success over the last 10 years?
Look, probably perseverance, I think, would be a big one. But also, as I mentioned, you know, in the early days, it wasn't a full-time job. And I actually think it's really difficult to run events like what I do as a full-time job, because there's not the money in it. And that's something that, you know, I think a lot of people still talk to me these days and say, you know, I want to start events. I want them to be profitable. And it's like, well, good luck. That's not really how events work. You know, it's a very hard slog. And you know, sometimes I think, why have I got into a business that every month, you know, now we have several events where we have to get bums on seats. And, you know, that's a continual marketing hard slog where you never really get much leadway. You can't get ahead of it too far, but it's still hard work in some cities for us. So I think, you know, having the staying power has definitely helped us. And, you know, definitely in Brisbane, we were really the first company to run events for the digital space, particularly for marketers. So that definitely gave us an in that we've been able to maintain. Sticking around, being there and having consistent good quality of speakers and process has definitely helped us as well.
It's the brand itself, I think, has come on, you know, from a sort of objective third party point of view. I think over the time, and this is the thing I think with events as well, is that over time, when people, the more and more people that have been to them and experienced them, the brand itself becomes a bit more robust, if for want of a better word. It kind of has a bit more of a reputation, that kind of thing. And I think with any event, trying to get that in day one or even in the first year, second year, it's hard to do. But after 10 years, everybody knows the events.
Yeah, definitely. That helps. And as I said, I think it's about quality as well. It's just, you know, trying to maintain our quality and being clear on what we're bringing the audiences as well. So knowing our customers really well. And I feel that, you know, in the last probably 2 to 3 years, I've done a lot more in that space. Right. I feel like I know our customers now better than I ever have before, which is great, because it means that, you know, we're able to be more meaningful as well. And
Who is a typical Interactive Mind customer? Who's your, you know, what are you looking for? If anyone's, you know, out there listening to this.
So really it's someone working in marketing. So they've been in marketing, you know, usually at least a year or two, right up to, you know, the experienced marketer. So we very much aim to enhance someone's existing knowledge. We're not doing 101 sessions, but, you know, to keep helping people grow beyond that. So they're marketing, typically they're working for a brand. And they can be small, medium or large size businesses. That doesn't, you know, worry us from that perspective. We always try and cover a range of, you know, speakers that can speak to both the big brands and the small brands, so that we cover that off. We also get a lot of agencies coming along, and we get a lot of, you know, sole traders, consultants and other players in the industry as well. But from our core perspective, we're really targeting that marketing role.
Of all the marketing that you do for yourself, what's the one channel that you think works the best for you?
I knew that answer. It would be easy, wouldn't it? I think this changes fairly regularly, to be honest. I think LinkedIn is a bit of a secret weapon at the moment, actually.
Oh, wow, really?
I'm loving the responses and feedback on LinkedIn. The engagement, I think, is great. But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call that a huge marketing channel for us. I suppose it's one of that we use. We still try heaps of things, particularly in some of our cities where we haven't been as long, and we're trying to reach more people. Brisbane, for me, I think grew quite easily because I had the existing networks, and that made a really big difference. In cities where I personally don't always have that level of network, it's a slower drive, which is somewhat frustrating, but we're still just trying to reach people, you know, who are marketers in whatever channel that they're using.
If you were going to launch into a new city, you're not in Perth yet, are you?
No, not yet. No,
if you were going to launch into Perth tomorrow, what would be the first thing you would do?
So the way we grow now is by putting on a chapter director in each city.
Okay.
So that is someone who's working in the industry, ideally well connected, and capable, and has a good understanding of, you know, I suppose marketing as a whole, and in particular digital. So they're capable of finding people who can share insights around certain things. So the first thing for me to do is to find a chapter director. I've been really lucky that in many cities people have come to me. In fact, there might have been people from Brisbane who have moved and said, hey, there's nothing like this around. Can we start Interactive Minds? And we're now set up in a way to enable that. So we've got the systems and processes in place to support people in different cities running it. So, yeah, definitely the first step would be to find that right person who can anchor it in that city for us.
Is that the sort of advice that you would give to other businesses that were trying to do the same sort of thing, move into new territories?
I think it's really hard to run a territory from outside that territory. So we launched into Melbourne as our first city, and for several years we were basically flying in for events. Right. It not only adds a whole level of cost for what I've already explained is quite a slim profit business, but it doesn't enable that local relationships. No matter how hard you try, it's just not possible to develop them in a, you know, fly in, fly out kind of setup. I think, you know, our learning has been to try and get the people on the ground that can support it and use their networks as well to grow it, you know, locally.
Anything you've done in the past 10 years that you've now looked back on and go, well, that was a waste of money and you wish you hadn't done it?
Look, not specifically. I guess all the businesses I've run have been self-funded. Right. So I've never had heaps of money to burn. I've always been quite cautious with how I spend it. There's nothing that I would kind of regret from that perspective. I think, you know, I put a lot of thought into, you know, the big spends that we do have. And there's always optimizations and learnings, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably, you know, some of our web costs that we've had over the years have exceeded what I would have liked them to be. And some systems and things like that would be the other one, but nothing really jumps out.
Looking at it from a more objective point of view from you, and not thinking about Interactive Minds here, when you listen to all the speakers and learn all the stuff that you learn from putting on your events, is there a particular channel of marketing, of digital marketing, that you hear people talk about every time that say that businesses should get right? And I know it's not a one size fits all for all businesses, but is there something that you think all businesses should be doing as a basic 101 digital marketing?
Oh, look, how long's a piece of string, really? But I mean, I guess I would say the answer from me to that is that if you don't have your website right, then everything else is a waste of time. You know, I guess this is something when I was consulting and having agencies and working in agencies that was always the first step, because what's the point of sending traffic to a website if it's not converting, or B, it's not adding value to the visitor? So making sure that you kind of focus on that to start off with, I think, is really important.
Yeah, I totally agree. A lot of people that I've spoken to say a lot of digital marketers still talk about the value of email marketing. They think that that's a channel that is often neglected by businesses because they feel that people don't open emails or anything. They feel that people don't open emails anymore, but that it still delivers better return than social and all those other pay-per-click and everything else. What would be your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I agree. Email is our, you know, I guess that answers the question that you asked me before, really, in terms of what channel we use, you know, consistently, and email would be it. You know, running events on a frequent basis, we do send quite a lot of emails. And look, I think, you know, we would love to be better at sending those. And what I mean is more targeted, give people more options, things like that. If anything, you know, systems and process restrict that, which is always, I think, for every organization wants to get, you know, their data working better for them. So that's definitely one of our wish list items as well. But yeah, email is really important. And I think as well, don't underestimate the value. You know, when we think of email as marketers, we think of bulk emails. But when I'm in a fix and I really need numbers for something, it's personal emails that get me there. So that's how I get, you know, extra people to events, extra interest in things that we're running. I'll sit there and I'll send out 50 one-to-one emails if I need to. And they are much more likely to convert than me sending to a big database.
Yeah. That's a really interesting. Often we talk on this podcast about the ability to sell. And that a lot of marketers should be able to sell as well. And those that have learned early on, and you mentioned early on about the customer service in Coles. Yeah. And I think at 14 years old, standing on a checkout talking to customers is a valuable learning experience, because you have to talk to people of different walks and different ages and all those kind of things.
And by the time I was, you know, 17, I was running the front end. So I had 10 registers under me and I was the one that dealt with all the problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, refunds or something didn't scan at the right price or whatever it is, you know, that I think elevated that experience further.
And what people think of very minor learning experiences back then are massive opportunities for you to understand how people think and understand how you can turn what is a negative experience into a positive experience and all those kind of things. So it's all that sales customer service thing that I think then, as you say now, you know, you lean on when it comes to, you know, pushing extra numbers.
Yeah, definitely. I really value that time that I had at Coles. I never would have appreciated it back then. I mean, I was, you know, between, 15 and 19 or 20, I worked
thinking
there.
About running party events.
I was leading the fun life going out, you know, after working a 10-hour shift, that kind of stuff. But I think that experience that I got then has really set a baseline customer service for us and for my expectations of people that I work with as well. So, you know, I like to pride ourselves on strong customer service, making sure people are happy and just ingraining that in the organization. And that's been really important. But I think something you touched on regarding sales as well is equally as important. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of marketers aren't getting exposure to the sales area.
Yeah.
I was quite fortunate when I worked in agency side that I was doing, I moved into kind of strategic advising. And part of that is really being part of the sell process. So I was doing pitches, I was able to kind of define the solution and then go in and present it and take it through to a sale. That became part of the job that I was doing, both at Pat's Digital when I worked there and then in my own agency. And I think that has, you know, once you've got that sales experience, it just opens up what you can actually do. And I think a lot of marketers, unfortunately, aren't getting that exposure. And I would really encourage anyone to try and get it, no matter what job you're in now. If you can actually talk to people and convince them to buy something, then you're just miles ahead.
Yeah, I've looked back on startups and failed startups that I've known or been associated with. And you know, 2 years in and I sort of go, they might have something like 10 or 20 customers on board. And I go, how are you not out on the street knocking on doors 8 hours a day trying to sell into more customers? You know, certainly in the retail space.
Definitely. And, you know, I think don't be mistaken that I love sales either, because I think that's a common, you know, myth that you have to really love it to do it. I think for me, it's just a way of life now. You have to be able to do it. Whereas I've worked with, you know, people over the years that are too afraid to make a phone call, and not even a sales phone call, just a follow-up phone call or to get information. And I think, you know, we need to be able to do these basic things to be efficient in what we're doing.
Yeah.
I worked with someone a few years ago who I asked them to find out some information and, you know, 3 days later they were still waiting for a reply email. And I was like, well, why didn't you just call them? Like, you know, those basic things, I think we need to just remind ourselves to practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking back on the events that you've done in the last 10 years, and I'm really going to put you on the spot here now. who's been your favorite speaker in the last 10 years?
That's not actually super hard, because
you wait till I ask you who's the worst speaker in the last. No, I don't.
That's much harder. Actually, I've got a bad habit now, because I mean, I guess we've run at least 10 events a year You know, that's what we started off with, 10 a year. We've dropped down to 8 because we do a full day conference now. So each city would run between, you know, nowadays they run between 6 and 8 events each year in each city, and generally we have 3 or 4 speakers at each. So all up, there's a lot of speakers to consider, but probably one of the most fun for me to get on board, to market, and to kind of say I did, was I brought the head of innovation from Lego Labs out to Australia to speak a couple of years ago. And that was amazing because not only was he a lovely guy and awesome to deal with, but, you know, I got to promote that we had Lego speaking at an event, which was pretty cool.
That must have sold out pretty quickly.
Yeah, it sold out. We got media around it, and it was good fun, and something that we don't always, you know, get access to. So, yeah, I was really, really proud of that.
How did you get him?
I can't give away all my secrets, but look, I did a lot of
give us a rough
speaker.
Idea.
Yeah, look, I find people that speak and that seem to do a good job and get good feedback, and then I contact them.
Okay,
that's pretty much
that's
what it
we
is.
Need to know.
And I use LinkedIn a lot.
Lego is one of my when I always write down my sort of top 3, top 5 brands. Lego is always in that list, just because it's.
Yeah.
Such an enduring brand that hasn't really, well, it has evolved with the times, but it hasn't lost its core kind of beliefs and, you know, and those kind of things. And it's had a rough ride over the years, but yeah, still number one brand for me, you know, one of the top, you know, number one brands. So.
Yeah, definitely. It's got a lot to admire, and their story is really inspiring as well, I think, in terms of, you know, what they've ridden through and come out of. And, you know, all the products they've got out these days is amazing.
When you heard him talk, what was it about him that was that made him your number one speaker? Was it the content? Just was it the way he was? For other people who are out there who, you know, who want to do talks, who want to do speaking, what are the things that people could learn from those kind of speakers?
Yeah, good question. And look, I often write articles around this actually, in terms of, you know, things that presentations should include and what we can learn from them. That talk in particular, I think, you know, it was a combination of the brand he worked for, the role that he was in, which was basically testing out marketing for Lego back then. So yeah, it was just a really interesting role, and he had an interesting take on it, and he could share some of their test and learn methodologies and practices as well. So I think, you know, that was a couple of years ago. We were talking about failing and testing to fail and all the rest of it. It was quite a timely topic as well. In terms of, you know, my tips for presenting, actually, I wanted to say I presented something this week, actually. I did a presentation, and, you know, I expected to have to spend a few hours putting it together and thinking about what I was going to say and potentially practicing it. And I expected that I might meet some people there. But what I didn't expect was the awesome value that I would gain from actually doing that presentation. And I think this is something I'd like to highlight, because I'm always encouraging people to speak. You know, I think it not only establishes them and their thought leadership, but it's a good thing to be part of. And what I got out of this process was I got to review the work that I was talking about and look back on something, which I think is something we don't do often enough. So I was able to, you know, be proud of the work I'd done and also see opportunities that I could still leverage or what I could do differently next time. And putting a presentation together is a great way to have that retrospect in there. But as well as that, then I got to meet some really interesting people when I spoke, and I actually really enjoyed presenting and sharing some of my story. So there was a lot that I got out of it. Back to your original question of what should a presentation include, you know, I think that storytelling element is really important. I know that the more you practice a presentation, the more comfortable you're going to be doing it. So I think that practice piece is really important. And my advice is really just to share openly. I know some brands and individuals are really cautious about what they give and what information they can share. But in my opinion, if you've got to be guarded in a 20-minute, you know, conversation or presentation, then, yeah, you know, someone's not going to be able to take that and replicate the business. And I think you've got to appreciate that. And the more openly you can share some behind the scenes stuff, the more valuable it is to everyone in the room.
If you had the option to pick whatever speakers you could from around the world, who would you put on stage?
Oh, good question. I'd like Gary Vee and Seth Godin to come out.
He's coming out
soon,
isn't he, Gary Vee? Are you going?
I know. No, not this time. I did go last time. I've got a conflict this time. But
I've got to say,
I don't really value that type of event.
I, to be honest with you, I was a very anti-Gary V person. And then all of a sudden I became a very pro Gary V person. And now I'm back to the anti Gary V person. It's not because the trouble I have with Gary V is it is just so consistently the same message over and over and over and over again.
And he produces it a lot. You know, there's a lot of it out there. Yeah. So you don't know how new it's going
to
be.
No, I've listened to a couple of his keynote speeches and honestly, word for word, some of them are just like they're almost identical, and I'm going, and I appreciate people can't be different all the time, but you know, it's how many times do you want to speak about your wine business, Gary? I'm like,
there is saturation out there, I think, but still, hey, I wouldn't say
no,
get him, and I think he should start doing events like mine rather than the events that he does, because really, everyone knows that those events are going to be 90%. Rubbish and 10% Gary. And that's, you know, I think not where I would want to align my reputation.
Yeah. That's a good point. Okay. Last three questions. When you look at other brands out there, what are your favorite brands? Things that you buy frequently, enjoy, and sort of try and live up to, those kind of things. And that's in any category, not just, you know, events.
Yeah. Look, I know you ask these questions, and I've been having a bit of a think about it. And I'm the only brand that I'm consistently diehard for is Apple.
Oh, okay.
Which I don't even understand.
Why you don't understand why you're diehard for it, or you don't understand the brand?
Well, a bit of both. I mean, as a marketer, I look at Apple and I go, "Yep, you've got an awesome brand." Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's one of the most valued brands in the world. But as a customer of Apple, I still get emails from them trying to sell me something less than what I've already got from them.
Right.
And I think you should know, you know, especially given it's a technology product, you should know every computer, iPhone, watch, earbuds, whatever product I've got, you know, because it's all linked to my account. Mm. And yet you're trying, you don't have it together from a marketing perspective. Yeah. They're not trying to upsell me properly. They're not, you know, recognizing the products I've got. So I think from a marketing perspective, there's a lot they still need to work on. Mm. I'm a bit confused about why I do love them so much when I can see these massive flaws in how they communicate with me as well. But I would say aside from Apple, there are probably no other brands that I feel really strongly aligned to right now.
How do you feel about, I know we've spoken about it a couple of times before, but how do you feel about Coles now as generally as a brand from your experience in the past? Do you still shop there, or are you a Woolworths person?
Look, I was a diehard Coles person for ages. I could not go to any other supermarket because I knew the layout so well. Like every supermarket was kind of the same. So probably for a decade after I finished at Coles, I would only ever shop at Coles. Yep. I do shop online at Coles now, but I am surrounded by two Woolworths that are closer. So now I do a bit of both. It depends how I'm shopping as to where I go.
Supermarket traitor.
Yeah, it took me a while, actually. It really did. But now I can do either. I've gone.
You've not gone Aldi yet, though.
No, not regularly.
No, I can't cope with it. It just freaks me out. I go, these look like the things that different. I buy, but they're not the things that I buy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think, you know, the fact that the supermarkets have white labeled so many products, or not white labeled, but, you know, self-branded. Yeah. That actually really made it hard to switch as well.
Yeah.
That definitely was a challenge initially. I was like, I have to think about it too much in Woolies, whereas in Coles, I know exactly what I'm getting. So,
okay, yes, right.
I'm now like ambidextrous, though, from a supermarket perspective.
I'm gonna add a follow up question to that favorite brand. Are there pieces of software that you use in your business, or people that, you know, just things that you've seen that you go, actually, that's a cool piece of software, or something that you're sort of reliant on that you use every day from a software perspective?
Yeah, look, I'd say there's probably heaps. LastPass is something that I love.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's, you know, one that you don't necessarily give credit to, but it's in the background all the time.
Good point.
I'm liking Asana for task management.
Okay, yeah, that's two.
We use a bit of Canva, a bit of Photoshop still in there.
Do you know what? I don't understand. I don't get Canva. And it's not because I'm a graphic designer, because I'm not a graphic designer. And I've done brands. I've worked with a lot of graphic, you know, I've had an agency that did branding and creative and things like that. I just don't get Canvas. I just don't get it. It's attraction. I've tried so many times to use it, and it's not that it's hard to use, but I'm just, maybe it's just me. I have the same issue with Dropbox as well, but that's another, I think.
I do like Dropbox actually.
I think a lot of people would like to see Dropbox taken out the back and shot, but that's another matter. But anyway, go on. Sorry, Canva.
There you go. Yeah, go on. I think Canva is handy when you're trying to create some even graphic templates that multiple people can edit. So for us, it's quite handy. We can create a template and then share it with all of our chapter directors, for example, and use it across different cities and events that we're doing. Yeah. So in that kind of context, they don't need Photoshop then. They don't need any design capability. They can use Canva.
Yeah.
I've occasionally used it if I'm doing an invite for something and I just want a quick and, easy approach. And I don't really want to get into Photoshop at the time. Mm. So, I can see some use for it, but I still go to Photoshop a lot.
Yeah. Maybe I'm just using it wrong. which could easily be the problem.
You don't need it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, so anything else? Any other software other than that? What's your go-to for email? What do you send out your email through?
Well, I use Apple Mail actually. Okay. Gmail powered.
What about the bulk emails? Because I just got one from you literally 5 minutes after we started talking. So
did you? Yes. There you go. Bizarre. I didn't even do that. That's great. We're using MailChimp which is really just because it kind of works with the system that we're using as well. So it's integrated with that. I think at the moment we have a lot of wish list items for email. Yeah. So. There's a lot we would like to be doing better in that space, and that's definitely one of our projects on the cards.
What do you use to compartmentalize your customer base so you know that people are in Sydney or people are in Brisbane? Are you doing that?
We actually have separate databases at the moment. Okay. So just how the system works, that's how it's set up. Right. But that's not ideal either as we expand into other things. Yeah. Hence why it's on the cards as a project at the moment.
Second to last question, what's next for Interactive Minds? I mean, you've been doing this for 10 years, and do you see an eventual exit, or do you just sort of say, I'm taking Interactive Minds to the grave? I mean, or I'm waiting.
Neither at the moment.
I'm waiting until the three kids grow up and then I'm handing it over to them. It's like a family farm.
I don't really have massive plans long-term as to whether I'm going to be in it or out of it. I would like it to continue running successfully. Yeah. I'm very excited about some of the stuff that we've got going on. And in the last, 3 years, I've done quite an extended business course. I've now got a business coach. I feel it's been really reinvigorated in terms of our plans, what we're doing. I wrote a book last year as well, which has really helped me to kind of understand my business and my audience and where I want to be. So that's been really helpful. And we've just launched a new product this year, which is a marketing mastermind group called The Circle for marketers. And in terms of what next, we've got more products on the way. So events are not the be-all and end-all. We want to really be, the success partner for marketers. We want to be their go-to when they need to, stay up to date, when they need to upskill, when they need to connect with other marketers. So, I'm excited about what we've got in the works.
Fantastic. So, very last question. How do people get in contact with you if they want to ask you a question?
Yeah, look, I'm pretty easy to find. If you looked up Louisa Dahl, you would find my website. I'm available at louisa@interactiveminds.com. So I'm pretty open to people emailing me. And you can find me, Louisa Dahl, on pretty much all social media.
Especially LinkedIn, because you use LinkedIn a lot.
Yeah, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram.
Are you a big Twitter fan?
We have been for our events.
Right.
Definitely, I think from an event perspective, Twitter has a role to play. But we have noticed it's decreasing, particularly this year in terms of engagement, and that we're much more likely to get event information shared on Instagram or LinkedIn now.
Oh, really? Yeah,
big shift.
Yeah, Twitter's the wild west of social media. It's,
it's a lot out there. There's a lot of content on Twitter, and I think, obviously they haven't nailed it. They're not growing. So that's always a bit of a problem.
It's the channel for outrage is Twitter. If you want to find someone who's outraged about something or anything, they'll be on Twitter somewhere. So
exactly.
I find it, journalists that consistently use Twitter as a as a sample of what the common man is thinking is just the world's laziest journalism. But
yeah, it's not really representative, is it?
No. Anyway, I digress. Thank you very, very much for being on the show today. It's been very, very interesting. I cannot recommend enough to people that if they are in Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney or Newcastle, that they get their asses along to an Interactive Minds event. And check out everything else that Louisa is doing online. So once again, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.